announcing your host, Jody Levin-Epstein.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to Class February series of audio conferences on changes in social programs made by the budget bill that became law in early February, and the ones that might come about from the President's proposed budget. Today, our last in the series, but not least, we will focus on child welfare and impacts in the child welfare arena. But first, some shout-outs. In Virginia, 5 to 8 staff from the Department of Social Services have joined us today, as they have for previous calls in this series. And hello to Region 7 Child Welfare staff with the Administration for Children and Families, where about the same number are tuned in today. And hi in Wisconsin to PATH, a treatment foster care organization where a foster mom is listening in. And in Chicago, hello to the team around the conference table at Prevent Child Abuse America. My guests today are Rutledge Hudson of CLASS. Hey, Rutledge.
Hello.
Hi. And also joining us is Dave Burns, the director of the Arizona Department of Economic Security. Hello, Dave.
Hello.
We are most fortunate to have Dave on the call today, but as well, CLASS is always fortunate because Dave serves on the board of directors of the Center for Law and Social Policy. So we're very appreciative, Dave. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's turn to the question of money, Rutledge. The funds for child welfare come from pots of money dedicated to child welfare. Let's call those the dedicated funds, okay?
Okay.
All right. And then child welfare also increasingly has been funded outside the child welfare silo. Turning to the dedicated sources of federal funding for child welfare, can you tell us what they are? And then later on, I'll get to ask you about the new changes related to them. But first off, what are they, the dedicated sources?
Well, there are two primary ones, or the two biggest ones, are Title IV-E, which is about out-of-home placement, foster care, and adoption assistance. And it basically pays for the room and board cost around foster care and adoption. It also pays for casework and training that goes with foster care and adoption. It's really important to note that while this is the single largest federal funding source for child welfare, it does not generally pay for services that children and families need. Services either to prevent child abuse and neglect, to provide treatment and rehabilitative services to children who have been abused so they can heal, services to parents to help address their problems so that the families can be reunified safely, or when that's not possible, the services that children need to prepare them to move to an adoptive home or some other alternative permanent home. It's also important to note that this placement money, or this 4E money, is mandatory, and it's based on the eligibility of particular children. So in other words, for each child who's eligible for federal foster care assistance, the federal and the state governments share the cost of providing foster care or adoption assistance for that child. The money is mandatory, which means it does not have to really go through the appropriations process. The federal government is simply required to provide funding, a share of the funding, for every child that's eligible.
Rutledge, you're using that ugly word, mandatory. we've been through that before in other calls in this series, but you mentioned that one of the distinctions about mandatory funding is that does not go through the appropriations process. Why is that important? You just threw it out there. Why is it important that it doesn't go through the appropriations process?
I think it's important because it's money that state agencies who are caring for children in foster care can count on. That money is going to be there. There's not going to be the negotiations that happen in the appropriations process about what the amount of money is. There will be the amount of money there available based on how many children are eligible.
Okay, I interrupted you in your riff on the dedicated funds. Get back to it.
Okay. Well, the other big sort of pot of dedicated funds is what we call Title IV-B money, which is really more about the services component of what children need. I talked about how 4E is really about placement or out-of-home placement and supporting that. This Title IV-B is really about providing a range of services, from preventing abuse and neglect to helping reunify families, stabilize families in crisis, and that kind of thing. There are two parts to 4B. The first one, subpart one, as we call it in our technical stuff, is child
you
welfare.
You can't do
services.
That. You can't do that. Keep going.
And the second one, and that's a discretionary pot of money. It does have to go through the appropriations process each year. The second part of 4B is what we call promoting safe and stable families. And this has both mandatory and discretionary funds in it. And again, it provides a broad range of services to children and families who are in crisis. In addition to 4E and 4B, there are a number of smaller programs primarily related to the Child Abuse and Prevention and Treatment Act, which are dedicated to child welfare funding. But it's really important to note that just under half of all federal spending on child welfare comes from funding sources that are not dedicated to child welfare. For example, TANF, the welfare program, social services block grant, and Medicaid. Those funding sources have an important role in providing services to children involved with the child welfare system. So we have to pay attention to those programs as well as 4E and 4B.
No kidding, if it's just under half the funding. Well, let's then now turn to learning about the changes in what you've described as the dedicated child welfare funds and then the other pots of funding that you were just mentioning. And maybe I should throw in an acronym, create one, the other pots of money. Could be the other pots, the top funding. No, we won't add a new acronym to everybody's plate. But you're right, we clearly need to do both. So can you start by telling us, or just giving us a list of the basic changes in the new budget law made to the dedicated funds?
Well, the three biggest ones are that there are some significant cuts to the 4E foster care maintenance payments. There's some significant cuts to 4E administrative and child placement dollars, and we'll talk about what those are in a minute. And then there's some, relative to those cuts, modest increases in the Promoting Safe and Stable Families program.
Okay, so we've got three, and Rutledge, I'll run you through each of those, and Dave, I'm also going to ask you too. But first, Rutledge, your top one was the 4E cut in foster care maintenance payments. How much of a cut are we talking about?
We're talking about, at least according to the estimates that CBO gave for the bill.
Congressional Budget Office?
Yes, sorry. $380 million over 5 years is what they estimate that will cost. And remember, this is a mandatory program, so the federal government only achieves these cuts by changing who's eligible for this program, and that's what they've done here. So these changes are going to be there until Congress changes the eligibility criteria again. So we should be looking at these as cuts that are going to be there for a long time, not just for 2006.
So basically what happened?
Well, basically what the bill does is it overturns a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, which we call Rosales.
Whoa. Now I'm going to give you a chance to dig deeper here. What is this circuit Ninth Circuit Rosales bit?
Okay, well, basically what people need to know is that the federal government does not provide foster care maintenance payments for all children in foster care, but only for very poor children in foster care. About half the children that are in foster care, they have to meet an income eligibility. And sometimes what happens is that children are removed from their parents' home and placed with relatives temporarily to see if the situation can stabilize. And this happens before the child welfare agency officially takes custody of the child. If it turns out then that they can't put the child back with the parents, they sometimes then have those grandparents, for example, become foster parents and care for the child. What happened in Rosales was that the Department of Health and Human Services said that in order for a child to be eligible, they had to be eligible in the home that they were legally removed from. And so, for example, the mother's home. Not the home that they were living in at the time that the legal removal happened. And what the Ninth Circuit said is, HHS, you've been interpreting the statute incorrectly. What really matters is whether at the time the legal removal occurred, whether it was before or after the child was formally placed with grandma, but when the agency took custody of the child, did the child meet the income eligibility criteria at that time? And in the case of Rosales, the child did meet the eligibility criteria, and therefore the Ninth Circuit instructed the states under its jurisdiction to provide federal foster care payments to children who met that income criteria. And therefore, the number of children able to receive Title IV-E broadened as opposed to what HHS had been interpreting before. What the administration did in its budget proposal last year and what Congress has done through this final budget bill is to overturn the decision, basically to make the statute now fit what HHS's interpretation was before.
So the bottom line is that fewer kids are eligible as a result?
Yes. Thousands of children that would be under the Rosales analysis eligible for federal foster care maintenance payments are no longer eligible.
And we're one of the states in Arizona where that affects, because we're part of that ninth district court. We're going to lose between $600,000 and $1 million a year. That's really problematic for a couple of reasons. One is that they're going to make it retroactive back to October of last year, and it's going to be pretty difficult for us to even figure out which cases and how much money for each one we're going to have to pay back. And we're well into the year, so it's going to be difficult to make up that. And the decision really is contrary to what I think is the philosophy of promoting relative care, because it's it really is going after the funds exclusively for those grandparents and other relatives who have come to the rescue of their children and then find that they need this assistance. And now we won't have the federal support to maintain that. We'll have to do it entirely with state funds.
And Dave, could you play that out a little bit more for us? You mentioned, I think, a $1 million cut just for this piece. What does that mean, so that folks have a sense of what $1 million means to you? It doesn't have to be an exact percentage, but give us a sense of how significant that amount of money is to you.
Well, in the overall budget, it's a fairly modest amount of our child welfare expenditures, but when you think of the number of staff that mm-hmm. might support, that might be the equivalent of 20 staff people with their fringes and all mm-hmm. for a whole year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rutledge, could you get us back? This whole Rosales conversation was in the beginning of your talking about the cuts to 4E foster care maintenance payments. Anything more we should know about those cuts before we move into the other 4E cuts?
Well, I think Dave has really summarized it well. I think the bottom line message is this is contrary to the policy of supporting relative caregivers who step up to the plate and try to help children when their parents aren't able to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, are you thinking that the message that grandparents are being cut out will resonate in the state or in states generally?
Well, frankly, we're going to continue to provide the payments. It just makes it that much more difficult to get the funding in order to maintain those services for those cases. And it's just a disincentive for the state physically.
Yep.
For using the grandparents, even on the beginning basis, to see if we can stabilize the families that
yep.
way.
Yep. Rutledge, could you jump to the other 4E cuts?
Yes, the other 4E cut comes about by clarifying, or I should say limiting, what states can claim under administrative and child placement funding. And this too is mandatory money, so the bill makes changes that are going to be longstanding until Congress changes them again. CBO estimates that these changes will produce cuts of about $174 million over the next 5 years.
Well, Rutledge, we're in tough times. It sounds like this is a cut on overhead, administrative overhead. Is it? What exactly is it?
It's not, and that's a really, really important question that you've asked, Jody, because, people often think of administrative costs in federal programs as determining eligibility, the filling out forms, that kind of thing. But what we're talking about in child welfare is casework. We're talking about finding the right foster home for a child, determining and assessing the safety of the home, determine whether foster care is even appropriate. All of those things that are sort of the core of achieving safety and permanency and well-being for children is what these administrative and child placement dollars pay for.
Dave, when I was asking you earlier to help us understand the context of the $1 million cut that we were discussing earlier, you immediately jumped to the implications for the ability to have adequate resources, adequate staff. Now, on top of that, what Rutledge is now describing is a 4E administrative cut. And it sounds like they may be critical to funding the workforce. I'm assuming you think that's right, but could you play out the implications for us in your state as you're looking at this?
The implications in Arizona are extreme for this particular cut because, again, this is talking about a cut in the funding for relatives, kinship care, grandparents raising their grandchildren. The main issue here is that unlicensed relative caretakers will no longer be able to bill for the casework kinds of services to maintain that, the administrative kinds of supports like case management, designing the service plans, things of that nature. Not the services themselves, but the staff to do it. About a third of our kids in care are in these unlicensed relative facilities or homes in Arizona. This is going to mean about a 40% cut in our administrative funding in Arizona. We may be hit harder than most states, but it's going to be very, very significant.
That's huge. 40%?
Right.
And you'll have to accomplish that in 1 year?
Well, I wish. We're going to have to accomplish it retroactively back to
October 1st. Oh, my God,
October
yes, that's
1st.
What you were saying. Wow, okay.
Now, in this area, though, there's still an awful lot of unanswered questions. We don't know how to figure out what those expenses would be retroactively. We haven't kept our paperwork exactly that way. And there's definitions or there's provisions in that we can actually bill for some of these cases, but not for others, such as families that are actually applying to be licensed. But there's criteria in there on how long we can bill for that is yet undefined.
And let me jump in for a second here, if I can, Jody, to give an idea of how complex it is. I just think it's worth noting that in the administration, in the president's budget proposal for last year, for 2006, they had a proposal around doing something very similar to this, making changes to the claiming for administrative and child placement dollars, and the cost estimate there was $457 million over 5 years.
So the expectation was that the there would be a savings of that amount?
Yes.
And now they're saying the savings is less, but they're saying they're going to do it the same way?
Well, as you know, in budget documents, there's not a whole lot of detail, so it's not totally clear. But the point that I'm trying to make is that there are a lot of assumptions and a lot of definitions that haven't been sorted out yet. The stuff that Dave's going to have to grapple with. And so while the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that this provision may cost $174 million over 5 years, it really may be a lot more. And I give that the president's proposal that seemed very similar to this, although, again, as you know, in budget proposals there's not a lot of detail, was going to be $457 million over 5 years.
I got to move away from cuts for a minute, at least to catch my breath. And you mentioned something at the beginning, Rutledge, the promoting safe and stable families, which was not cut. What sort of services does promoting safe and stable families fund? Say that 10 times fast.
Exactly. Well, see, that's why you need to use acronyms.
I know. You're going to win today.
Anyway, promoting safe and stable families funds a broad range of service, and it really starts on on the front end in terms of providing some services for prevention, for stabilizing families in crisis, family support services. It provides services to help reunify children when they have to be removed from their parents' home, to help them be able to go back safely if that's possible. And when that's not possible, it provides some services that help get the children ready for moving into an adoptive home or moving into a legal guardianship with parents. So it's a broad range of services.
And the increase, what's the increase all about?
The increase is $40 million for the fiscal year 2006. But I need to note that at the same time they created that additional mandatory funding of $40 million, there was a decrease of almost $10 million in the discretionary side of promoting safe and stable families. And it's a one-year increase because the Promoting Safe and Stable Families program has to be reauthorized this year. In addition, I just want to do a little footnote and say that the final budget bill for 2006 did include an important increase to a small set of grants that really help promote collaboration between child welfare agencies and courts. So I don't want to leave that off the the good side of the ledger as well, or the helpful side of the ledger as well.
Well, help us put this together. We've got the cuts we were talking about at first to the placement 4E part of the world, and then we have increases to services 4B. Are these dollars fungible? In other words, could a Dave Burns of the world smush the monies between the programs so that the loss we were talking about in one side of the equation can be covered by the increase in the other side of the equation?
I think the answer is no. Even someone as creative as Dave Burns, I don't think can do that. And that's because these, as we noted earlier, these funding sources really pay for different things. The cuts to foster care maintenance payments and to casework services simply can't be paid for under the Promoting Safe and Stable Families program. Even if the dollars were the same, I mean, even if the cuts were in a comparable magnitude to the increases, which they aren't, they simply fund different things.
Okay, Rutledge. But I've heard you say, and I've also heard Dave say, and certainly the president has said for a number of years, that we need to invest more in services, the kinds that aren't covered by the placement for e-monies. In fact, didn't the president campaign in 2000 with a promise to increase funding for the program I cannot pronounce, and we'll do an acronym from here on in, Promoting Safe and Stable Families. I did it. So isn't the increase in services money a good thing in taking care of the problem? I know I'm throwing out the same question, but in different ways here.
Yeah. Well, it is a good thing, but any addition is good. We desperately need more money for services. But this additional funding is not going to make up for the other cuts to foster care and casework services. And the other thing is it's really not anywhere close to what we need. I mean, one thing that people may not know on the call who aren't familiar with child welfare is that 40% of the children whose situations are actually investigated and found to have been abused or neglected get no further services at all. The investigation is all we offer. We determine they've been abused and neglected, and then we offer them nothing. No counseling, no foster care, nothing.
Well, Rutledge, I'm supposed to know a bit more because I work in the same office as you, but I find that number hard to swallow. And so the message for the lay folks who don't work in child welfare is that 4 out of 10 children who were subject to investigations and found to be abused have gotten no subsequent services at all?
That's right. And you may find that hard to swallow, but that is the data that states report to HHS, and HHS puts out in an annual report. The annual report is called Child Maltreatment, and the most recent year we have is 2003, but that's been a pretty consistent number for a number of years now. We simply don't have the capacity to be providing services, even foster care, to these kids right now. And you're also right that the president promised in his initial campaign to increase Promoting Safe and Stable Families.
There you go.
Money.
You're tripping up.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly. At the time, that program was all mandatory, and the president promised to increase it by $200 million a year, to increase it from $305 million annually to $505 million.
Oh, that's a big jump.
It is. And it would have been great. But unfortunately, the president backed off that promise, and Congress didn't add that mandatory money. What they did was create a new pot of $200 million in discretionary money.
Well, so you got the discretionary.
Yes, but it's important to note that we haven't even gotten more than half that discretionary money funded in any year since that passed. Right now we're at $89.1 million for fiscal year 2006. So, you know,
it's significantly less than even half of what you had hoped in discretionary dollars.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
All right, and I think what this story that you're telling us now is helping illustrate that textbook definition of mandatory and discretionary funding that you were giving earlier. It's really a concrete illustration with sort of a visceral take on the importance of that vocabulary. It's much more than vocabulary when we're looking at discretionary monies. The way to look at it, if you'll agree with me, Rutledge, is the way to look at it that discretionary monies may never materialize.
That's exactly right. And you called mandatory something like a nasty word.
I don't remember either.
And I think it's a really important one. I mean, because this shows you whether or not you're going to be able to get the money and whether states can count on having that money as they plan for the next year.
All right, though, Rutledge, there has been an increase in mandatory money for Promoting Safe and Stable Families in 2006, which amounts to $40 million. So shouldn't we be at least content with that?
Well, I think that we should be very glad to have it, and we hope that it will be continued. As I mentioned, the Promoting Safe and Stable Families program has to be reauthorized for this year. I remember earlier I talked about the 4E placement money as being mandatory and assuming that changes would stay in place for a while when you make a change to a mandatory program. But some mandatory programs, like Promoting Safe and Stable Families, like TANF, the welfare program, are a little bit different, and that is they provide mandatory money, but Congress only provides that mandatory money for a set number of years.
So it has to happen for those years, but at the end of the years, that time frame, it's up for grabs?
That's right. They've got to reauthorize it again, and it's up for reauthorization this year. We certainly hope that Congress will reauthorize it and that they will keep that additional $40 million in there. In fact, some of us even hope that the President will go back to his promise in 2000 and push hard and get Congress to pass an increase in the mandatory money up to $505 million a year. But the point is that reauthorization has to happen for any of these mandatory dollars to be available.
All right, we've been discussing these dedicated funds, and at the outset we identified a whole set of other pots of funding. Let's talk about what those were real briefly. Rutledge, can you illuminate for us?
Okay, well, one of the major ones is changes to the Medicaid program, which would restrict access to Medicaid-targeted case management services for children in the foster care system, as well as some other children. And these are really important services, and I want to take just a second to kind of describe what they are. Many children that come into foster care or become involved with the child welfare system have a range of medical needs. They may be mental health needs, they may be that the child has physical disabilities, and they really require a level of medical case management that is pretty substantial in terms of coordinating their medical care, but also coordinating it with the schools and with other social services and making sure that the foster parents are aware of and connected to all of these services. And it has been a source of funding now that child welfare agencies have been able to draw upon to provide the very services that the children in their care need. And what the President proposed last year and what the final budget bill for 2006 does is say that child welfare agencies can't draw down Medicaid for many of those services anymore. There's a lot of ambiguity as to exactly what that's going to be, and regs have to be issued. But based on the discussions and the statements that have been made over the past year, I think it's a fair statement to say that a significant portion of these cuts are going to hit children in the child welfare system or in foster care. And we can't give an exact dollar figure, but the total estimate for the changes to Medicaid targeted case management is $760 million over 5 years. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of that's going to fall on children in foster care. In addition, some of the changes in Medicaid that will make it harder for folks to get access to health care. For example, I know on Friday you had an audio conference where you had discussion about some of the changes in the Medicaid program.
With Judy Solomon of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Uh-huh.
Right. And Judy talked about how there was now authority for states to charge increases in co-payments.
Right, they didn't have to, but they have the authority to.
Right, and mm-hmm. premiums and authority to restrict the benefit packages. And they don't have to, but they have the authority to. And one of the things that Bob Greenstein said in his audio conference, which I think kicked off this series, was it was kind of a 1-2 punch, that the 2006 final budget bill laid the groundwork where states had these options, and then the proposal that the President makes shifts a lot of costs from the federal government to the state government, which is going to put pressure on them to make those kinds of changes and cuts that hit beneficiaries directly. Now, foster children are protected in some of these cuts, but what I think is important for us to pay attention to is the families who are not yet in the child welfare system, whose children have not yet been removed from their care, if they are impacted by these increased co-payments or premiums or restricted benefits, they may fall into the child welfare system. And I say this because we have lots of good research that shows that many children in the foster care system are there because their parents aren't able to access medical care that they need. And they basically end up surrendering custody to the child welfare agency to try to get their children the services they need. So I think, you know, one of the big things we need to pay attention to is what's happening in targeted case management. And so
child welfare experts need to reach out to the Medicaid agency and staff to get a full understanding and to play into the regulatory process as well. Is there any wiggle room in the regulatory process, do you know?
Let's hope.
Okay.
Let's hope. But you're right, they need to do that, and they also need to be weighing in on what they're going to do to families outside of the child welfare system so that we don't end up having more children come into child welfare. And to give a contextual frame here, I mean, if you look at the Urban Institute's data, which is probably the most comprehensive on all the different funding sources that come into child welfare, they estimated that about 11% of all federal child welfare spending in 2002 came from Medicaid, not for routine health care, but for targeted case management and rehabilitative services.
Did you say 12%?
11%.
Sorry.
Yeah, about $1.1 billion.
Wow. Okay.
You know, I think a big lesson for all of us is that since we're so interconnected with all of these funding streams, we've got to guard against pitting one pot or one contingency against another. We can't say we want more money for child welfare, so why don't you cut Medicaid, or why don't you cut TANF or some other program? Because when there's a cut in any of these programs, the fallout is for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, while we're on that, let me ask you about the changes in the welfare cash aid program, particularly the changes to the TANF work requirement and child care funding. What is happening in that area outside of the child welfare silo that totally, in fact, impacts on child welfare?
Right. In Arizona, I'm responsible for the TANF program as well as the child welfare, and so we've been quite interested in the changes that resulted in TANF. Basically, what happens is that we have to put more emphasis on getting our clients into work requirements, having them participate in either paid employment or subsidized employment or various types of training, educational pursuits that may count as a federal work requirement. And as we do that, we're going to have to take some of the money that we've had as flexible funds and transferred in or helped to support child welfare. That money is going to have to go back into the TANF program for expanded needs for child care, expanded needs for employment counselors and other supports in directly in the welfare programs. When that happens, that means that funding that we have typically transferred into other programs, and child welfare being probably the biggest, will no longer be available for those activities. So it's up in the air how much that's going to be, but it is going to put more pressure and less availability of funds in the child welfare programs.
Well, and you were saying earlier that it's really important for folks not to look at budget numbers and the situation in a siloed way. As the head of an agency over all of it, how do you message this issue of the TANF changes and the child welfare needs so that each agency or sub-agency kind of see the way to collaborate best?
I think it's very important that we continue our dialogues, even in an agency that's part of a TANF and a child welfare in the same agency. We sometimes don't talk enough internally about what the implications are for each other. And I'd say that for those of us that are in child welfare, reach out, find out what's happening in TANF, find out ways that we can continue to build the relationships, because most of the people in child welfare are also poor. So if we can continue to build supports and use the job and employment services through TANF, that will be a real positive activity that we can continue to work on.
And so, can I just jump in
sure.
for a second and say, you know, there's also going to be a regulatory process on the TANF side in terms of defining, for example, what activities will count towards the work requirements. So people need to be jumping in right now and talking with folks, and the child welfare folks need to be talking to the TANF folks, and they need to be talking to the folks at HHS up here in Washington to say, you know, what activities ought to be counting.
Well, Can you concretize that a little bit, Rutledge, in terms of, from a child welfare perspective, what might be a regulatory recommendation that reflects a child welfare concern? And, you know, the thing I'm really thinking about, and I can't put my finger on the proper nouns here, but there was a research piece, I can't remember who the researcher was, who took a look early on TANF work requirements and the potential relationship between increases in the child welfare caseload. Does this ring a bell for you?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think it was in 2001, I put out a paper trying to synthesize what research was out there on the impact of TANF on abuse and neglect. And there were a number of red flags that were raised. And I think the way to look at it, just to sort of put it in the simplest terms,
mm-hmm.
you know, is that the families who are on TANF, who are struggling the most, who are having the most difficulty complying with work requirements, are families who have a number of challenges. They may have a mental health problem that's never been diagnosed or treated. They may be trying to treat it themselves with the use of alcohol or drugs, so they may have a substance abuse problem. They may have a learning disability. They may have a physical disability. They may have a whole range of things that interfere with their ability to work, but also make them very vulnerable in terms of their ability to parent adequately. And if we put more pressure on these families by requiring more of them and providing them less, not offering them the child care they need, not mm-hmm. offering them the medical services they need or whatever, mm-hmm. we may push more of those families into the child welfare system.
Right, and maybe playing and riffing off of Dave's point about getting each part of the agency to talk to each other and identify their issues. If there's an increased work participation rate requirement, to the extent that the jobs are most appropriate for those at risk of child welfare services, you know, if we could see the mutual interest in both systems, then the work participation rate is enhanced at the same time as folks are not captured by the child welfare system. Does that make any sense, what I've just said?
Yeah. I think it does. I mean, I think one of the things to think about is that right now, before this bill passed in earlier this month, states had a fair amount of flexibility in what they could require of people because of the way the caseload reduction credit applied and the way that participation rates were calculated. And those things are changed. And I know you talked about that in the TANF audio conference, so I don't want to go through that. But what happened was that a number of states got very creative and started allowing people to participate in substance abuse treatment or mental health services or programs to help them with their learning disabilities or vocational education and rehabilitation services, a whole range of activities, and they let that count towards what they as the state required of them to get their TANF grant. But it's going to be much more difficult if HHS narrowly defines the set of work activities that are in the statute and excludes those kinds of things from counting. I
mm-hmm.
think there is the possibility that HHS can define it in such a way that many of those activities would count, and I want to urge people to be advocating with folks at HHS, with folks in their state, to go to HHS to make sure that those regulations allow these activities to count, because they do, as you said, accomplish both goals. They move people towards the ability to work to the greatest of the capacity that they can, and they help them be better parents and take better care of their children.
We need to jump to the president's proposed budget, and Rutledge, we're going to sort of really have to race to get in all of the important issues that are looming here. And if you could just give us a quick take on the proposed budget and what it might mean for child welfare.
Okay, well, the first thing is that for the fourth time in a row, the president has proposed what he calls the child welfare program option, which is basically an optional block grant. It would allow states to agree to cap the amount of foster care funds they receive in exchange for being able to use those funds more flexibly, for example, to provide services, not just room and board and casework. So that's
what I thought the whole goal here was, to be able to make more money for services available to states. Why are you saying it? Am I just picking up on tone here?
You are picking up on tone, and it's because I don't believe this proposal really will get more money to states for services. And here's why. Remember that on average, 4E covers only about half the kids that are in foster care. So think of the foster care costs that states have as somewhat fixed. I mean, a child that's in foster care today can't go home tomorrow, even if you could provide a set of services starting tomorrow. There's a time delay. States have to have money up front to develop the services that help stabilize families, that prevent abuse and neglect, that help children heal, that help parents deal with the issues that brought their children into care in the first place. All those things have to happen. The capacity has to be developed, the service has to be delivered, and the children and families have to respond in order for the caseloads to start going down. But under the way the president's proposal works, states aren't going to really get the upfront money to invest. They're going to be caught in this sort of catch-22 where they need to bring their caseloads down to free up money to develop the capacity to provide the services, but those caseloads can't come down until they actually have the services available.
Okay. Dave, when I introduced you, I failed to mention your role in El Paso County, Colorado, where you did really nifty things. And one of the things that you did was you brought foster care caseloads down substantially. Rutledge has been talking about this upfront investment issue. Did you have an upfront investment to develop the service capacity that Rutledge has been talking about? And did you have fun?
We were very fortunate at the time that I started in El Paso County was just when the program was starting back in 1997. And we had some upfront money because of that in programs of prevention and early intervention. And I'm afraid right now that the new ones, the funding having to go into programs like child care in order to support that, we won't have the same opportunities to use the TANF funding for that upfront investment.
And so that TANF is really not as available to services and programs outside of welfare recipients per se. Is that what you're saying? It's sort of drying up as a revenue source?
That's right. And the money, any of the flexible money that we've had, we've already invested. So there isn't a new pot of money that can use in that way.
Rutledge, could states, though, use TANF to provide child welfare services? Is that allowable now? Has anything changed in that area? And what will be the likely impact of the new provisions that have just been enacted? Is that going to make any change?
Well, I don't think there's any changes that make it unallowable to use this to provide the sort of services that Dave has talked about, because as you pointed out earlier, those services both help move people towards work and help them better. The problem is really what Dave described, which is if you have to have the increased number of people in prescribed activities,
work activities,
you're going to be putting all your money towards getting people in those activities, but even if it means you create some kind of job like that. So the money is going to be going there and to provide child care while people are in those sort of programs that actually will count towards the participation rate. So for me, it's really a function of whether the regs that HHS comes out with allow enough flexibility for that. But I think it's still going to be hard because you have to have so many people participating in a fairly prescribed list of activities.
Okay, so let's assume it's going to be hard. But let's also assume that we need to have child welfare services. Are there other sources of funding if TANF indeed is drying up?
Well, I wrote a paper, I think in 2003, that talked about a range of funding sources outside of the traditional child welfare, or what we've been calling in this audio conference, the dedicated child welfare funding sources. And it's interesting to note that a number of them are ones that the president's proposal either eliminates or significantly cuts. For example, the community services block grant, the president proposes to eliminate that. $630 million a year. There are also all the cuts that we've talked about to Medicaid. And as I mentioned, according to the Urban Institute's data, that constituted about 11% of child welfare services.
This is the case management through Medicaid?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. The case management and rehab services. Social services block grant is another important funding source for child welfare, and the president 2007 budget proposes nearly a 30% cut in that program. There are also cuts around or flat funding of mental health services and substance abuse grants, block grants, even though the president's budget and his commissions that he's pointed has created say that there's inadequate number of services available for those things. So yes, there are things that are out there, but the president is either not increasing funding where there needs to be increases, or that he's cutting funding even more than it's already there. So I think it's going to make it really hard for states to find other sources of funding to invest in the services that they need to provide to bring the caseloads down, which was what the optional block grant envisioned.
Well, Dave, speaking of the optional block grant, you're the administrator out there in Arizona. Would you run for it? Would you take the president's optional block grant yourself? And after you fill us in on your answer on that, could you also give us a sense as to which types of states you think might take up the optional block grant if it became law?
Right. You know, if I could go back to the current year before this Rosales change and the other changes in reducing $14 million out of our budget, if I could keep all of that and use that as the block grant, I might consider it. But with those already being cut out of my budget, it would just be too scary to think in terms of a block grant based on the already reduced amount of money that will be coming from the federal government for the Title IV-E program. I would say the only states that might consider doing that would be those who are anticipating a huge decline in their out-of-home care anyway, and then they would be able to keep any of those savings in their budget. I don't know of any states that can be that confident, because the proposal doesn't adequately deal with issues like the meth epidemic or the state of the economy. You know, the caseloads tend to go up when we have a downturn in the economies, and since we can't really predict the future, it would be a very scary proposition to be able to enter into a fixed amount and not be able to adjust it for those other kinds of conditions.
Rutledge, what else in the budget do we need to know about?
Well, I mentioned the cut to social services block grant. I mean, it's talking about $500 million cut, which is about 30% of the block grant. And that's just a huge hit to child welfare.
And why is it that we're seeing this as an issue, as a huge hit, and what are the implications there?
Why is it a child welfare issue? Well, basically, according to the most recent data we have from the Urban Institute, in 2002, 12% of all federal child welfare spending came from the Social Services Block Grant.
If you that 12% number keeps coming up in different contexts.
Right. 11% from Medicaid, 12%
from...
It keeps me tripped up all the time. But the point is, it's a huge portion of the federal funds that come to support child welfare services. And if you look at SSBG itself, at least half of the funds nationally are spent on child welfare activities. I mean, it's really the single largest funding source for prevention, early intervention, family support, reunification, and adoption support services out there. It's considerably more than Title IV-B and CAPTA combined. And taking such a big cut to that program is another reason why I think that the optional block grant proposal is even more concerning than it has been in past years.
And you were saying, correct me if I've got this number wrong, you said nearly 30% cut in social services block grant?
That's right. It would go from $1.7 billion to $1.2 billion.
Dave, in Arizona, are you using social services block grant for child care right now? And if so, in what way are you using it?
Yeah, well, we're using it for child welfare and for child care. But the money is basically put into a pot and cost allocated to a lot of different programs, so it doesn't fund this particular service or this particular program. It's part of the money that goes in, so any reduction here has to be made up with funding from other sources. If the funding from other federal sources, such as from Medicaid and from Title IV-E, is going down as well, this simply leaves us with the option of trying to get this money from the state legislature or cutting back on our programs.
Well, Rutledge, in terms of the new budget proposal, can you tick off a list of other elements that might impact on child welfare? Again, this is not what's been enacted, but what's been proposed.
Right. The proposal continues to try to, I would say, go after targeted case management and rehabilitative services in Medicaid as a way of providing services to children in the child welfare system.
You mean more cuts
more
than
cuts.
The ones you described?
More cuts, yep. And I can't quantify the dollar figure there because of the way it's proposed. It lumps a bunch of different things together, but it looks to be significant cuts there. We have flat funding for the Promoting Safe and Stable Families program. We have flat funding for the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act programs. We have cuts to programs for mentoring children whose parents are incarcerated. We have flat funding or cuts to the substance abuse and mental health programs. We have flat funding for what we called earlier the Child Welfare Services Program, which is part of 4B. It's the subpart 1 of 4B that's discretionary funding. Discretionary funding. So we have a whole host of either additional cuts or just keeping things where they are when we already know that amount of funding is inadequate. Since we go back to that figure that we talked about earlier that you said you didn't believe me on, that 40% of kids that are substantiated as abused and neglected aren't getting any services at all.
Well, Dave, I know you have a particular focus and concern on the flat funding for child welfare services. Can you fill us in on what it is about this flat funding, proposed flat funding, that makes it a front burner worry for you?
I wish it were flat funding, but unfortunately, you have to look at the entire package and money that's coming in. So even though one funding source might remain flat, if the others go down, it just puts pressure on the entire system. And that means that without the services, and Rutledge is right, 40% of the families don't get any services, but even the 60% of the families that do get services don't necessarily get all of the services in as timely a manner as what they really need. And so as we take out the funds, especially the flexible funds that we can use for services, it moves more families into the mandatory kinds of approaches, such as the foster care. And in the long run, it could end up costing us and the federal government even more money, because that the flexibility and the ability to use the 4B money and those more flexible kinds of pots is what we need in order to reduce the incidence of child abuse and to also provide services for the kids to be remaining safely at home.
Dave, you used a word that creeps into conversations during this series, which is over the long run. You know, everybody talks about over the long run, these cuts don't save. Can you tell us how you can communicate within your state the long-run implications and how a cut today costs you in the long run?
Right. If we have staff that can go out and spend some time with families up front, get them connected with programs such as TANF, with other services, spend time to make sure that families utilize Medicaid-funded supports such as substance abuse treatment earlier in their substance abuse problem, then we are able to reduce the future incidence of child abuse and get to the families quicker, because when we get in too late into the cycle, that's when we have to remove the kids, and when they come into care, they stay in care for a long time, and many of them either end up aging out of the system or going into our adoption program. So the earlier we can intervene with the right kinds of services, the more chance we have of eliminating or reducing the need for the most costly kinds of interventions, such as institutionalization of the kids or long-term foster care. And the money that's being cut out for the most part is money that we could and should be using for those earlier interventions and ways to support families and to keep kids safe, hopefully as much as possible in their own homes and communities.
Mm. Well, let's hope folks begin to hear this. What I'm going to try and do is task myself with pulling together all that you guys have covered and then give you a final question. And listen, don't hesitate to tell me I've got something wrong here. But what I'm hearing is the big picture between the budget bill changes that just passed and got signed into law in February and the proposed 2007 budget is that we're going to see the following. Significant cuts to foster care maintenance payments for certain children living with relatives. Significant cuts to administrative and child placement funding that supports important foster care casework. Significant restrictions on access to Medicaid transitional case management services for children who are in foster care. Significant proposed restrictions on access to Medicaid rehabilitative services for children in foster care. Significant proposed cuts to social services block grant. Increases, but not nearly as much as promised, to the safe and
Promoting safe and stable families.
Thank you. And the court improvement project fund that you mentioned, Rutledge. A proposed optional block grant of foster care funds. And finally, proposed flat funding or cuts, as Dave was mentioning, for a range of other programs. Taking it all together, Dave, what's a state administrator like yourself to do?
I don't know. It sounds like a need for a faith-based initiative to me.
And beyond that?
And beyond that, we really need to take a look at the best investments for the money that we have. Continue to show what we're able to do with what we've got, and to demonstrate that further investments from the federal and state levels will actually result in better services, more safety for children. So we can't just give up. We have to continue to use the resources that we have and use that as the leverage and to point out that the good things that we're doing really make a difference in the lives of the children and families that we serve.
Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Rutledge, what's an advocate for children in the child welfare system to do?
Well, I think that's the same thing. Don't give up. And one of the first things that I would say is get in the budget process for 2007 right now. Don't wait for the budget resolution to be enacted, which sets how big the pie is, and then argue whether the pie should be cut this way or that way for child care, for child welfare, for TANF, for housing, for, you know, any number of things. Let's get in there right now and make sure that Congress understands that the level of funding for all of these programs is not what it needs to be, and that they've got to cut. They've got to, you know, get away from the cuts that they're talking about and make a bigger pie, so that we don't end up down the road fighting over crumbs. I think that also means getting in there and having conversations with members of Congress about priorities. What are our priorities? Are we going to, as Dave suggested, make investments in our children's future that we know will give them better outcomes, or are we going to continue to offer additional tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans? I mean, those are the kinds of choices that Congress is going to be making as it looks at putting its budget resolution together, and we as advocates need to get in there right now and weigh in with them and let them know we're not going to let this go unnoticed, and we expect them to commit the resources and investments that we need for our children and families.
Well, many thanks to you, Rutledge Hudson of CLASS. Thanks, Rutledge.
You're welcome.
And Dave Burns in Arizona with the Department of Economic Security and the Board of CLASS. Thanks, Dave.
My pleasure.
And to all of you listening, our next audio conference is March 24th, and it will focus on the marriage provisions of the new law. And to everyone listening who's invested in low-income families and struggling children, don't give up. Thank you all very much. Bye-bye.